Steve Quirk. Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Travel disruption could last for days after flights were cancelled, leaving thousands of passengers stranded following an air traffic control technical fault. It meant that flight plans had to be input manually by controllers. Juliet Kennedy is the operations director at National Air Traffic Services.
It will take some time for flights to return to normal, and we will continue to work with the airlines and the airports to recover the situation. Our absolute priority is safety, and we will be investigating very thoroughly what happened.
London is now the world's largest pollution charging area after the ultra-low emission zone was expanded to include the whole of the capital. People who drive in the zone in a vehicle which doesn't meet minimum emission standards are now required to pay £12.50 daily fee. And price rises in British shops have slowed to their lowest rate since October last year, but keep going up significantly. New data from the British Retail Consortium says that prices rose 6.9% in the year to August. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Alex Dan.
How come the minute sorting money crosses your mind, you'll do anything to put it off? Like fixing a tap that's been dripping for months. Or straightening those wonky photo frames. It's funny that. But if you talk to NatWest today, we could help you get the important things done. Forget the toolbox. It's time to nail your money stuff. So whatever your plans, big or small, let's chat. Search NatWest. Tomorrow begins today.
Coming up, Africa in Focus.
Hi, I'm Dr. Emmanuel Eko. The early signs of a heart attack can vary. The most common include squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, and a sense that something just isn't right. It can be easy to dismiss the early signs of a heart attack, as the symptoms don't always feel severe. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio, Africa in Focus.
Africa in Focus is sponsored by Dermadew Lotion. Visit dermashark.co.uk.
Colorful radio. Good morning, good afternoon, or even good evening, depending on the time zone that you are connecting to us from. Welcome to Africa in Focus. I'm your host, Julius Mbaluto. This day, we are greatly honored and privileged. We have very powerful, and I say powerful, ladies who have done a lot around the world. I am joined by Professor Carol Boyce Davis.
Thank you.
And also Professor Wangui Ngoro. You know, listeners, those who are watching, it's amazing because we are talking about Professor Carol, all the way from New York, University of
Cornell University, New York.
All the way in the New
York. Originally from Trinidad and Tobago.
Amazing. And also Professor Wangui, local here in the UK. So was University of London. So I just want to, you know, give you opportunity to introduce you better than I can, because if I do, I may leave out something that is very important. So let's start with Professor Carol.
Hi, good morning. It's such a joy meeting you, Julius, and also a joy being here in this space. Has a lot of history here, a lot of energy, a lot of ashe, as is said in West African spirituality. So I'm pleased to be here. And in fact, the person I wrote the last book on, Claudia Jones, did a lot of organizing from here, because this was a space for doing the work that they did, anti-apartheid, liberating Mandela, and so on. So I am currently a professor of Africana studies and literatures in English at Cornell University. And I'm stressing literatures in English, and this is a nice connection with Kenya, because I worked with Makoma Wa Ngugi, the son of Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, right after the killing of George Floyd. The university, as many of them did, had a logic of how can we try to improve how people are treated in this world, and they felt that the universities had a role. So the president actually had a statement that she thought every department should look at itself to see what it can do to make it better. So Makoma and I were on the phone talking, and we came up with the idea of having them change it from English department to literature as in English. And that was symbolic because the logic of an English department is a very colonial formation all over the world where English departments have been. They have been these colonial structures, and I call them colonial statues sitting in the middle of universities in plain sight all over the world. So other fields, history department or political science or whatever. But English departments are really doing literatures. And particularly now, when we have the rise of literatures across the African diaspora, Caribbean, African, and even African, we need to break down because there's so many national literatures, you know, Nigerian writers, Kenya, and so on, South Africa, regional, national, and so on. And then, of course, that white Caribbean diaspora. And then, of course, the diasporas of people living in places like Europe, here, France, you know, England, and so on. So we actually, most universities are doing literatures. They're not doing English, really. So we pushed it through, I say, because we were quite surprised that it actually happened. We changed the department from English to literatures in English. We had a number of people on board. Asian American literatures supported it. Latin American, lesbian, gay, and bisexual and literatures. Indigenous people literatures all signed on very early. So we didn't have any problem when we submitted it. And then the rest of the faculty just voted. So it's literatures in English. So we are probably one of the only ones in the U.S. to really do this. We are the leaders of doing that, and proudly so. But it's important to say that because it's doable, and many people just don't assume that they can actually make that change. But the students were, like, happy because normally they have to do, like, three courses in medieval. And then finally, by the time you get them in their senior year like I do, they're like, finally, they get one Caribbean lit course, and they're like, what? What has happened here? So they're graduating, and they never had knowledge of African literatures, the range, and so on. So we were really pleased to have that innovation there. But my departments are dual. I'm in two departments, two appointments, in Africana Studies, which is actually the first Africana Studies department in the country, founded in 1969 by James Turner, who actually sadly passed last year. And the idea of Africana Studies was to sort of accompany the fact that after 1968, you have a number of predominantly white universities, they are called PWIs, admitting black students. So these students come into the universities, but there's no structure for them, and they run into a lot of racism. As happened, I'm sure you know the histories of people having to be accompanied by even National Guard to go to elementary school and so on, white people spitting at them and so on. But at the university level, it was smoother. They came in, but then what was there? No structure. So eventually, students began to make demands for curriculum that would reflect their experience and their history. And this is how you get to Africana Studies. And we are proud that Cornell is the first university to actually have a full-fledged Africana Studies department with a library, with all of the structures that you need to really study these literatures. We have a master's degree, had a master's degree, but now it's a PhD in Africana Studies. And, of course, I work with a lot of students in literatures and English who come into the university, actually from all over the world, to study Africana Studies from different angles. But I often get letters from people everywhere, India, China. I want to come and work with you. I want to study Toni Morrison. They all say Toni Morrison. And then I tell them, by the time they come, they know there's a range that's much wider than Toni Morrison. And that's who I am, and that's what I do. I'm born in Trinidad and Tobago. I came to the United States when I was 19 because my brother was already there and worked at the university. So I went to the University of Maryland, and then I went and did a master's at Howard University. And at Howard at that time, Howard University, for many people around the world, was more significant than is Harvard today. because for black people it was Howard. Yeah. And that's where everybody went to really encounter the best of black intellectual excellence. So at Howard, at the time that I was there, one of the founders of the Negritude movement, Leon Damas, was on the faculty there. So I ended up working with him for my thesis. And on the faculty as well were people like C.L.R. James, who taught Pan-Africanism. So it was not unusual to walk through campus, and you may run into Stokely Carmichael because he may be visiting campus, and run into all the sort of named people would always come on campus to just be on the Howard campus as a historical marker. So we are really pleased. And keep in mind, Howard as well was the place where people like Azikiwe and the others got degrees very early. Nkrumah came through Howard as well after being at Lincoln University in the U.S. So I was fortunate, I think, to have had a very rich encounter in terms of knowledge and getting to understand myself as a human being in the world without limitations in terms of geographical space, as an African person, global African, we're calling it, and an African diaspora experience and culture. So because after Howard, I got a Commonwealth scholarship to study at the University of Ibadan, Nigeria, and there I studied literature in the English department, as I said. Ooh. I studied there. And at that time, my advisor was Daniel Zevbaye, one of the most important African cultural literary scholars. And on campus, I was fortunate to be able to meet some of the famous writers who would come through Ibadan as well. Ibadan then was the place too, just as Howard was.
The equivalent of Avant.
Exactly. Yeah, for one to be able to get that grounding. So this is why, you know, with my colleague Wangui, I say I'm really fortunate and blessed to be able to have had such a rich experience so early in my life, and then to really be able to play that, take it forward, which is my logic always.
Yeah.
I don't think knowledge is for oneself. It is for...
It's for sharing.
Sharing is for community enhancement. It's for making us have a better life in this world and clarifying things that people are thinking about sometimes, but they don't have the language or they don't have the, you know, the history or the context for it. And often we are able, if you've been trained, to provide some of that space and knowledge for them. So that's pretty long, but I have a long experience.
It's shorter than you think. Your CV is longer.
Thank you. No, you might wonderful. Be right about that.
This is Colorful Radio. Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, Dermadew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, Dermadew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. Dermadew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
Professor Wangui, I just also want you to introduce yourself and, of course, the things you do before we embark on this book on leadership. And
Thank you. As you know, I'm from Kenya, and I came to study in the UK at a young age, like Carol went to study. And I also went to study English.
Okay.
But it was very old-fashioned English, and I'd come from a progressive curriculum from Kenya, again, linking us. Kenya had already been through that moment of epiphany, and as students in secondary school, and right from one, which is when you go to secondary school, we had already started studying as part of literature in English.
Yeah.
I had a whole curriculum of 6 years in literature in English. So I'd read all the big writers, not only in English, but I studied French. So I studied French African, Francophone African writers.
Wow.
Maria, you know, Maimuna, I read that when I was 14. Hampati, but so many writers. By the time I was at the age of going to university, I already had an African literature
experience.
In English experience.
Wonderful.
Wow. So when I went to university, I went to an English department in the UK, and it was a total cultural shock. Part of our curriculum, as you know, in Kenya, we did have to study English literature in the traditional sense, but it wasn't the center of our academic learning. But now it was the center, and I found this very difficult, although I've come to terms with it more as an adult, because some of those big writers were dealing with the continental issues, even though they don't, and the whole colonial experience, even though they weren't mentioning them. As a scholar now, I can see the value of Shakespeare, Boccaccio. Mm-hmm. I can now see it, whether I agree with it or not. I can see the value. But at that time, as Professor Davies is saying, there was nobody to help me to decipher that. So I was very fortunate, because I knew that the department was of Nairobi was still alive. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of my holidays in Nairobi University. I met Professor Michere Mogo. I think Gugi had already left. But the tradition was there. And they used to have these amazing public lectures. And they were on all topics, like colorful radio. They were mainstream. So they were talking about all kinds of things, but from a literary perspective. So I used to do that every holiday. And the British holidays are long. They're from the end of June till October. So I'd spend many months with my colleagues, and I was allowed to attend class with my peers. Although I was not part of that university, I was allowed to be part of that experience. So fast forward, I did my PhD in translation studies, and many people know me better by the fact that I translated Gogi Wa Thiong'o's books from Kikuyu to English, and that was a big milestone moment. I was at the right place at the right time with the right spirits. I'd read a lot outside the academic curriculum, so I was very, very widely read, and because I was connected to literary people, I'd read Caribbean literature, which in Kenya, because of we were encouraged, Lamming and those people, Kamau Braithwaite, they used to come and hang out in Kenya, so we didn't know another life. We knew, you know, Rabindranath Tagore. We read the world, and we read the Commonwealth as well. So I was already rich. So this idea of being channeled into English, I thought, why would anybody come to, you know, just read the books at home and get a degree in something else? But that was a childish way of thinking.
Yeah.
So it is through my translation of Professor Gogi Wa Thiong'o's books that I actually first encountered Professor Carol.
I remember Matigari Majirongi.
Yes. And that's how I actually first encountered Professor Carol Boyce Davies. She was a young scholar, because it's many years
ago. We were all young. We were all very young.
I just finished my degree, first degree. Yeah. So I was really young. I was like in my 20s.
And she was also beautifully gorgeous. We were looking at her like, wow, beautiful she is.
All Kenyan ladies are like, I think also Caribbean ones.
Oh, well.
So you're
very kind.
We
can admire. We can admire each other. Yes.
So during that tour in America, I had never thought of becoming a scholar, but I actually found these young, and I'm saying young deliberately because they were young scholars who were academics.
Yeah.
And the first place I toured was upstate New York.
Exactly.
And I met Professor Carol Boyce Davies. I met Professor Ann Adams and Professor Janice Mays, and stayed in their homes. So I was like, this is the life that I want to be. And they were fierce. They were feminist already. You know, so there was, again, like my literary life, it wasn't something to learn. I found people ready-made, and they were part of who I now became. And I wasn't looking up to them, because they embraced me as their sister. And then our journey
began. At equal footing.
Pardon?
At equal footing.
Yes.
No. Sure. They were scholars.
They embraced you.
They embraced me. They had their PhDs. Yeah. And I was just out of my first degree.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
I was just then, I was 23 little years bit after, old when little I bit. Translated Matigari. So I was like, so I was looking up to you.
And we were like 30 maybe. Because I started, I finished my PhD at 28.
So you were around, it was your early?
So I was early 30.
So always I think of them as very much Because they were senior.
I know.
But we are generationally
not too far away.
That's how, to this day, I view Professor Carol Boyce Davis, Professor Anne Abdeson. They're very big scholars and very influential.
Yeah, Anne is a little bit older. She's my senior.
Yes, but
she retired already. I think she turned 80 this year or something.
Wow.
And she looks amazing.
She looks amazing. So I just saw these gorgeous young women and I said, that's who I must be.
Yeah.
So they're my role models. And I'm not saying this just because Professor Dave, she knows that this is the true history of what happened. Mm-hmm. And I came to upstate New York without Googie because the rest of the tour we did together. But I started my tour just with them. And they were so receptive. We were giggling. We were fun. It was so wonderful. And that now formed the rest of my life. I decided I wanted to be a scholar. I took my translation work more seriously than I would have done, although the world was demanding that I take it a little bit more seriously because it was a breakthrough moment, a young, middle-class, European-educated child deciding to work in from her mother tongue was like...
It was pretty radical,
it
actually.
It was unheard of. Mm-hmm.
We both have something in common. I've met Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o. I've interviewed him before. At the same time, he was with his son, Mukoma.
Mukoma.
So I've met Mukoma as well. We are known to each other. So I quite... really respect their work.
Yes.
It's amazing in those moments. You read their book, one of their book, and there are lines that stay with you forever.
Yes.
Right. I thought it was really important to make sure when we changed the name to Literatures in English, that Mukoma had an opportunity to bring that alive that his father had theorized.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's really a nice connection too.
Very nice connection. Mm. Now then, we are focusing on a very important issue. We are talking about black women rights, we are talking about leadership, and all this based on your new book. Do you want to introduce us to your new book?
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to say, though, that we are just finishing that last point, that in many ways we are the generation right after independence, because I was a child when Trinidad became independent, and we saw the transition. And I think I was listening to Wangui talking about her own education in Kenya. I think the idea was for us to have a transformational role in those societies via knowledge. And I mean, that was embedded in us via the lectures you heard from teachers, from prime ministers, and so on. So I think we still have that in our consciousness and that responsibility to really make sure you represent well and you take forward any of that history that you can to make sure that we have a better way of thinking through how we live in the world, period. I mean, as it relates to black people's experiences. So when I got to university position as a professor, again, very young, and I realized that now because many of my students are telling me they're 50 years old, and I'm like, how can you be 50? So I realized many of them were like, you know, just a generation after me, which is amazing to think about because they probably see me as like you did, you know, their senior and so on. But when I got to the first academic position that I had, it was at the State University of New York in Binghamton, New York. And it was in the middle, it was in the 1980s. So it was in the middle of the rise of black women's writing. So this is when you have all of the writers, like you mentioned, Mariam Eba and others, all of those works are now beginning to come out and all of that. And there was not a literary critical discourse that accompanied it. But you had a feminist movement and you had the rising of a black feminist movement by black women in the United States who were saying, well, black power did its work, but it left out women, I'm sure you know some of that history, that all of those black power movements with Stokely and so on, who we loved and adored and so on, they still had a context in which it was very male dominated. But so by the 1980s, black women were beginning to say, well, what about us? And this is out of that you have a black feminist movement arising. Different, totally, I have to say for your audience, from the mainstream feminist movement, because it really put in play the fact that black women were looking at the questions of race, class, gender, sexuality, in those combinations, in a variety of combinations, and not just looking at the question of race as well, which would have been the major vector for much of the Black power movements and interestingly also the Black studies movement. And I mentioned Cornell, right, Africana Studies, which would be coming with the same logic but in the intellectual place. So therefore people like me began to create courses that looked at Black women writers and for me in particular, although we were creating courses on Black women writers, because I'm from the Caribbean, as I indicated, I also was able to make sure that I brought in the Caribbean in that discussion. And then similarly, as I indicated, I had studied African literature at the University of Ibadan, the prestigious University of Ibadan. So I had that already, that training to be able to bring in African literature into the thinking about how we think about Black women's writing. So all of the early texts I created looked at the expansive ways to think about Black women's writing in global perspective, in international dimensions. Some of those books are titled like that. So I did all of that work. And then part of my, and we did specific texts on Nambika studies of women in African literature, looking at the representations of African women, which then was very limited, only to mothers, prostitutes, you know, and not many activists really talked about a woman who had done any intellectual work. And then the same thing in the Caribbean. We did a similar version in the Caribbean called Out of the Kumbla, Caribbean Women and Writing. So those two texts are really foundational for me and for many scholars to have a context in which they could think about how to understand this range of writing that was coming out at that time. So we were marking both the absence and the presence of this literature at the same time, if that's possible, and really claiming it as a field. And out of that clearly has become a field. But once I moved past that, the idea was that we knew then, at least for me, about the intellectual men, the Pan-Africanists and so on. You knew about C.L.R. James, Padmore, and all of the men across the world who were so fundamental, you know, in giving us a discourse, you know, in Harare, in Nkrumah, the political leaders and so on. But you didn't have a sense at all of who were women, where women were in that whole area. So I eventually, after being introduced to a number of possibilities of briefly engaging the work of one woman named Claudia Jones, began to look more fully into her because I was invited to be part of a Black feminist seminar at the University of Wisconsin. And there were other people who were going to be part of it, including people like Bell Hooks and so on. And I thought, if I'm doing that, I cannot repeat the same Black American narrative. I need Caribbean women there. And that's when I began to look for Caribbean women who were doing equivalent kind of thinking. And there was not a lot of material. So Claudia Jones, who is known here, as I said, did quite a lot of work in this center. Had a certain visibility at a particular point here, started the first idea of a London Carnival and actually ran it through the West Indian Gazette, the newspaper she founded here, was totally absent in terms of intellectual material. And out of that, I did a lot of research and one day went to Highgate Cemetery where she is interred, her ashes are interred, and discovered she was interred left of Karl Marx. And that's why the book Left of Karl Marx is named that. But it studies her deportation, it studies her writing, her poetry, her literature, and so on. So I kind of moved in a little bit of a more, away from just studying literature to a more expanded version of studying intellectual histories, if you will, of Black women via Claudia Jones. And that book has become really quite significant to many young scholars as well. It's, the older it gets, the more it's discussed. So then I discovered as I was moving through this kind of pathway that we were beginning to have a kind of presence of Black women in leadership roles, right? So Shirley Chisholm, the African-American Barbadian congresswoman, ran for office of the president in 1972. But again, these people run or they're involved in there and they kind of fade away and you don't know who they are. And gradually it became clear to me that I needed to study this question of black women's leadership a little bit more closely, and this is where this book comes from. So the book is titled Black Women's Rights, Leadership and the Circularities of Power. It was just published last year, and it's available online, but I just stopped at Daunt Books, and they said it's available from Ingram Books. So if one went into Daunt Books, they will order it for you, so you can get it there. And also, we have a number of other options if you want to get a copy that we can share the information with you. But it's published by Roman and Littlefield Lexington Books. And it has a beautiful cover, again, by a Kenyan artist, Wangechi Mutu. There's a really... that's why I said I have to really thank the Kenyans for making this happen. I'm serious. Which is unusual, because most of us from the Caribbean tend to work only with West Africa. So kind of, this is where we're from. Mm-hmm. You know, we only know that vector of Ghana. If you want to return, it's to Ghana, it's to whatever. But the more you study East Africa, and I was in Tanzania last year, you realize there's actually more commonality there than you realize. Definitely with the Indian-African combinations, I was amazed in Tanzania. The food was almost identical to what one can eat in the Caribbean. Which is
true.
It is true. Yeah. That was quite amazing to me. So I'm really pleased. On the cover of the book is Wangechi Mutu's work. It's a detail from four sculptures she did in New York called The Seated, about black women's leadership. So there's a Kenyan imprint right on the cover of this work.
Wow.
Amazing. Thank you, Wangechi Mutu, for your generosity in letting me use details from The Seated for.
Colorful radio.
Yeah, so the book, great work. And when we look into the motivation, let's say, and of course, you've been around and interacted with lots of historical moments and pertaining women and rights. When you look back, like, if we focus on U.S., for example, just before the civil rights movement, women were not able to vote. You come to U.K., it was still the same story. Women were not able to vote. But if you look from that moment and span across all that time, up to now, Africa now, at least we can boast, we have a couple of women presidents.
Exactly.
Tanzania.
Exactly. We had in Liberia.
Liberia. Malawi. Sir Johnson Sirleaf.
Yeah.
Malawi.
Yeah.
So when you look at the changes, would you say maybe the narrative of women rights should have changed with the time?
But that's the whole point of the book. My goodness, you hit it on the nail. In other words, what I found out from doing this research, and this is why it's titled Black Women's Rights, deliberately moving it away from talking only about feminism, because feminism is fine, but it's an ideological position. This is a shift at really talking about a question of policy and human rights. So black women's rights are human rights. I want to really put that on the table as the framing of this project. Not leaving aside ideological positions. But for me, you could be a Marxist, right? You could be a feminist. You could be a capitalist. You could be whatever. And one could choose one's ideological position based on perspective. But I'm saying that's not what this book is doing. It's talking about what are the rights that black women deserve as human beings living in the world, right? And out of the same Claudia Jones that I mentioned earlier, she had a framework called Half the World. In other words, that women represent half of the world generally. Most places it wavers, 49, 51, depending on age spectrum. You know, older women live longer and so on. Therefore, equal then in terms of demographic representation, but not equal at all in terms of the ability to decide what happens in their state. And this is a problem, because basically what has happened since independence, and while we thank those major leaders, the Nkrumahs and so on, Sekou Toure and all of the others, Nyerere and so on, once they came to power, they did not really put a sizable body of women in leadership. They may put one person running, letting her do culture or education or so on, but nothing beyond that. As a result, you did not have women then being trained in the knowledge or educational pathways of leadership, even if they wanted to. They were sort of excluded from it and were told, great, nice, you helped me win, but take a back seat now and look. In fact, the famous Nkrumah, and I am saying this because I teach a class on this topic, in one of his speeches, he really said he wanted to thank women for all the work they did, and he wanted them to use their femininity to go back and convince their men that they should be involved in creating a sort of Pan-Africanist world. So in other words, his framing, and it's not just out of evilness I'm suggesting or what have you, but mostly that people, the framing at that time for women was that you were not really the ones to lead. So the right to vote, I'm glad you mentioned that, under this Convention Against the Discrimination of Women, the right to vote, Article 7A, is really prominent. So we have achieved that. But we have not had the right to be fully represented in politics, which is the second point. There's a 7B, which is the right to have full representation in leadership decisions in your country. And it's easy because most women just want a better world. They want men, their children, sons, daughters, to really be able to share, go to school, eat well, and enjoy the benefits of living in a society. How to decide how to share those resources is critical. And what we have found that often with men alone in leadership, the decisions often don't get to those basic fundamental issues that women value and see as really significant.
Well, Professor Wangui, I mean, from Africa perspective, when you look into a few countries, Rwanda, extremely progressive when it comes to embracing women. Their parliament, I think women are more than men. When you come to Kenya, we have that bill which was introduced. I think it's 3/4 something. It's not fully been implemented. And when you look across Africa, do you say we are not there yet when it comes to equality, or we have improved?
I think there are two questions. One, which I was speaking to Professor Davis, is about what power means and where power is held. And I would say Kenyan women, for example, are very powerful and exercise their power not in those politically prominent positions, but they exercise their power fully. We all know people like Professor Wangari Maathai. I grew up after independence, and education was equal access, although families may have prohibited their children, girl children, from going to school. The state provided education for all of us as citizens, and the Kenyan Bill of Rights saw women and men as within. Right from the beginning, there was a Bill of Rights in our constitution of Kenya. So there are patriarchal traditional systems in place in a country like Kenya, and also our traditional cultures are also celebrated because we were coming out of a colonial setup, and we felt, or our elders thought, it was very important to preserve our cultures. And some of them do hamper, not necessarily by telling girls that they can't be leaders, but through the traditional practices and at the home practices, even sometimes from our mothers, discourages from taking up the full privileges of our nation state, which right from the get-go provided this to us. Then again, we were talking about what does circularities of power mean, and I'd like Professor Davies to address this, because in the Kenyan context it's very clear. We've had amazing women like Professor Maathai, who I've just mentioned, Professor Micheri Mogo, our first member of Women Parliament. She just passed away. A woman, Mrs. Onyango, she was just buried too, but she was in the first government of the, and we've had many other women in the Kenyan government, not as token figures, but as politicians in their own rights. So we had also, because of the people who went abroad, a big group after independence were trained in the Soviet Union and in America. So they encountered powerful movements like the, you know, civil rights movement and so on. And they brought that back to us. And you have people like Rebecca Njau, who's now a big author, and in her 90s, she started documenting. There was a Kenyan project in the 70s already documenting women. So we grew up knowing that this research was going on in the text, and we were also encouraged because they sent people out to their communities to look at who are the powerful women leaders. So there's a small book by Rebecca Njau, who just picks up some of these big women like Mekatilili. And so since I was 10, 12, 14, I already knew about this question of leadership in power. So I think the different contexts throw up different dynamics. So like Rwanda, they had these women. We had Joyce Banda. We had, I think, Professor Boyce Davis spoke about Winnie Mandela as the de facto head of the black people in South Africa when Nelson Mandela was in prison. So we need to look at the wide dynamics in our African world and see how the situations were playing on each other. Our leaders, Nkrumah, Kenyatta, and so on, they were here in London. Marcus Garvey, yeah. Amy Garvey, all those are not foreign names to us in Africa, because they were mingling naturally
right.
with those leaders, and there were women in those movements, and we could see the photos.
Exactly.
In the 60s, we grew up, we could see those wonderful women, and they were not always wives. They were there in their full right as leaders. So I know that those circulating influences are there, like Professor Carol.
Professor Carol. That's good. My students call me Prof. CBD because of my initials.
It's much easier.
So there are those also Pan-African dynamics that sometimes we get very linear and talk in national terms, that we're leaning on each other each time. And our Pan-African community is very mobile and intellectually very, politically and intellectually very mobile. Otherwise, we've known each other for like nearly 40 years, and we deliberately make these, like Professor Davis is here, deliberately comes to London. I deliberately go, and many other women scholars and leaders are moving all over the world. So I just wanted to say that our paths are nearly parallel, because I decided, I wanted also to mention that the 1975 Women's Conference UN conference was actually held in Kenya.
You're right.
Yes, this is true. All the women came
there. That's
came.
Right. Yeah.
So this was all the feminists from the West, from Asia. This visual impact. And I was very involved then here in London with getting the agenda of the Kenyan reception to feminism. And because we were here, the diasporic dimension of Africa, and you'll know big organizations, and I must mention them because they're really critical to where the African feminist movement is, which is influencing these leadership organizations. Like Akina Mama, where Africa were born here, where all these big scholars, Amina Mama, you name them, they were here because of their connection with Africa and the diaspora, and that then again fed into what was going on in Africa. And of course, we have above us these generations of amazing feminists already. Like Rebecca's 90. Can you imagine? She was a feminist already in the 70s. Michelle was a feminist. She's 80. Mm-hmm. So we have those 80-year-old, 100-year-old feminists. So for us, we breathed this naturally. It wasn't like a phenomenon or like a style. They were real. Wangari Maathai planting her trees from a feminist perspective. She deliberately, if you look at her book, she says she looked at the women's dimension and feminist. So I don't want to take over Professor.
No, this provides a lot of detail.
It's very important.
But I did want to say that I did study women's studies because at that time I felt it was important to have a theoretical understanding of.
Absolutely.
Not just be, although I was an activist, to know what was a scholarly side of these dynamics. Mm-hmm. So my master's degree is actually in women's studies in education, and now I'm looking at intersectionality in the curriculum. So having this conversation, how do you create an intersectional university? And I said to them, you don't need to do this intersectional thing, you just need to create a human environment. We don't need so many words, we just need one word. We need a human university, which brings all our humanity in its plurality. And they were shocked because they wanted a big lecture breaking down. I said human. Understand what
fully
in the
human.
Universal yeah. Declaration, what does the word human mean?
Exactly.
And make a university.
This is Colorful Radio.
During life, your skin is subject to many conditions, leaving your skin rougher and tighter. We want to help. At DermaShack, our unique formula provides day-to-day moisture for all skin types. Our signature cream, Dermadew, is a cream that can be used for both specific areas of dry skin and as a daily moisturizer. So why don't you try our cream, Dermadew, an intense rehydration cream that leaves your skin like silk. Please go to our website, dermashack.co.uk, to see our skincare range and begin your journey into total moisturization. Dermadew, total body cream, complete moisturization.
That looks like
that's wonderful.
Yes,
that's that is wonderful. So wonderful.
So, circularities of power.
Yeah, I'm so glad that Wangui talked about that. Actually, one of the things I learned indirectly from a young scholar who wrote about Daughters of Mumbi was that in many of the traditional cultures, there was always a kind of dual gendered power relationship. Yes. So you had men and women. You didn't just have masculinity as the dominant mode. And many people argue that that comes into more dominance with colonialism.
That's right.
Colonialism,
right.
When the colonial powers came in, they brought in that sort of old logic of masculinity and patriarchal power as the dominant ones and entrenched it. So we have to look at where that happens. And it's a debatable point. I mean, African women scholars have spent quite a bit of time really pursuing that question and looking at the fact that there were always African women leaders historically. Now we're beginning to see film which actually are named things like The Woman King and so on. And there's a Netflix series on Nzinga, right? So we're beginning to have some representation of that history. And the more and more we do work that brings it forward, the more knowledge will be available so that people will feel, as Wangui just said, comfortable in claiming that leadership possibility. So one of the things I found in terms of circularities of power, I use circularities deliberately because I wanted power to be seen not only as hegemonic or dominant, top down, but that power moves in different directions and we all have power in different ways. So I went again back to Stokely Carmichael. When he said black power, he was actually trying to articulate the fact that we need black power, we have black power. People like Marcus Garvey and others in the past also were trying to find ways that we could tap into that power that we have. So basically we all carry a certain amount of power that we can use organizationally if we bring it together in groups, often not just individual power, but that we have ways in which we can mobilize and use that power. So I wanted to get at the fact that power circulates and that the different levels of power. And also really critically, when you study women's representations in community, in their churches, in their community organizations, in their families, they're often women who are leaders in those situations. So that leadership is not just only at the state level, it's at the local level. And actually at the local level, the documentation shows is actually where change actually takes place and starts from. So the idea of power circulating is what I want to really leave as a really key theme, along with black women's rights. So leadership is not just dominance and the state power, but that we are all leaders technically if we're able to use some of the skills we have, and that we need to use that leadership to share the knowledge that we have, or the skills that we have, or the resources that we have. And black women have been doing that. I had an aunt who she was part of the Women's Federation in Trinidad and Tobago, influenced by Amy Ashwood Garvey, actually. Amy Ashwood came to Trinidad, I think I was a child, because I remember from the dates when she gave a talk in the Himalaya Club in Trinidad. And I remember my aunt and my mother going there, all excited because it was like a big deal. But essentially, Amy Ashwood identified herself as a feminist too very early. She said that was what she defined herself as well. But basically, my aunt would She ran like a community, it's called a breakfast shed. And sometimes she would get up in the morning, and I don't know where, you know, she got the resources from. But by the time she came back, she had enough to be able to feed a number of children from the neighborhood. And many people can tell you an exact story like this, wherever they come from, that their mothers and aunts were people who would feed the whole neighborhood with whatever they made. So that's a way of using power in a way to affect who is going to be able to move in the future. A lot of these children now are adults. They went to school. They were able to grow up and go to university and so on. So these are the people who influence people like me. And I tell people, I can only take it further because that's precisely what my aunt and my mother did without all the resources that I have, with all the knowledge that I have. And the other thing that Wangui said is really critical is that they also made a pathway for us to go to school. They wanted us to be trained and to have knowledge and education and to be able then to not be dependent, but be able to, move forward. And sometimes I feel I probably got too much of that because I'm very independent. I'm not dependent often where you should be sometimes, you know, wait for somebody to help you do something. But many of us don't do that. We kind of do it. If we have the ability, we just go forward and do what we need to. So circularities for me is that movement that Wangui described, where the knowledge circulates around the world across the diaspora. And it's also the fact that power is not unidimensional or only hegemonic. And also the fact that African culture and women's culture bring together the question of circularities all the time in their mythologies, in their language, in the way they create houses. Their houses are often round. In just the way that they think about the world in terms of life, you know, the human life, death, rebirth, all of those are circularities of power. So it's a natural kind of framework that we need to bring forward as opposed to thinking only in the linear way of power being dominant and subordinate, and who is under doesn't get the resources, and who is on top decides, and so on. We need more of the circulation of that knowledge and that power.
There are two issues. One, that I've seen a lot of leaders who are men declaring that they were feminist. And another issue is also in some countries now, the focus on girl child has left people crying, saying the boy child was forgotten.
Yeah.
How do you address those?
But you're right. And this is what I mentioned, why I mentioned about leadership being circular, and that the children, boy children, really often raised by women to lead, but often once they got the power, they didn't really share that power. They kind of took it. So I think mothers have to be responsible to really make sure their boys, their young men, have a certain kind of balance. I love Wangui's point about the human, and it's really a critical point because one of the theorists that I study named Sylvia Winter, she was really on record as talking about the fact that the definition of the human was the equivalent of the white male economic subject. In other words, he claimed for himself humanity and all the rights to decide what happens in the world, how the resources are used, and so on. And everybody else, Africans, women, and so on, had to really keep climbing up the ladder, trying to claim those identities or their rights as human beings. So there may be men who say they're feminists. It's easy enough for people to just use that language, but this is why my book is dealing with black women's rights. The next question you should ask them then is, how do you advance black women's rights? If anybody says they're feminist, good. Okay, good, we're happy. Okay, and then what have you done, or how do you advance black women's rights in terms of knowledge, education, the right to vote, the right to have representation in parliament, the right to be free of violence, the right to be able to control their bodies, all the right to be able to access resources and wealth. In a lot of cultures, in Mariamaba, I wrote about this, when the husband died, the wife was divested of everything. The family came in and took all those resources. And a lot of the languaging of the protocol of the rights of African women talk about the rights of women in divorce situations to be able to live their lives fully with their children and not be dominated by the families as well. So we have, we cannot say we have perfect societies, but we have models that are really powerful ones that we could go back to and work with. So that's what I would say about the men who call themselves feminists. Good. Okay, but what are you doing for women's rights? That we need to put them on record on that, right?
Sure. What about you, Wangui?
I think
professor?
Around this question, even women, because we've grown up in these colonial patriarchal formations, a lot of women that you see leading and advocating, we have had to educate ourselves. It didn't come as a biological given that we would understand. So the fact that Professor Carol Boyce Davis is writing for something which I think are so ordinary and normal for us, but she's articulating them, and for people, because we're grappling with these systems of power which have taken some of our traditional values but also placed us in oppressive colonial or enslaved situations which robbed us of any sense of humanity. So we don't even know how to behave and reclaim our humanity. So it's something I believe that should be taught in schools to young men and women, because as you can see, the colonial system continues to oppress even black men. So feminism for black women is not about hierarchies in that European sense, but in saying how can we reclaim our freedom, not just for men but for women. And also, so you have to learn, it has to be taught, it has to be practiced, it has to be embodied.
That's right.
And some of the fortunate things we have in our African communities is we're not so far away from our traditions and philosophical ways, whether it's in the Caribbean, whether it's in the United States. You see these practices of African communal cultures prevailing. How Professor Carol Boyce Davis is here, it's not a hierarchical invitation. She's my sister, so I invited her to come and partake and be of me as I would visit her, which we would do in our villages at home. And so it's like a family.
Yeah.
Continuity of knowledge is so rebuilding those cultures and reclaiming them.
Exactly.
When I grew up, and then I was going to say, like, you and I come from cultures which fundamentally believe in the Ubuntu philosophy. So sometimes I find here, because it's a very different relationship, if I do something, like I'm organizing this tour for professors, they say, what does she want? What's she getting out of it? And I'm not actually, that's not what I'm interested
exactly.
in. It's another value, which is bringing the human. I've done work for, you know, and she would receive me without asking any questions. I'd call Professor Davis and said, I'm coming. And it did actually happen in real life. I just called her. I said, I'm having a difficult time. Can I come? She didn't know me that well, but she said, sure. And she never to this day questioned, why did I come? But we had a very healing time together. And when we held this meeting at SOAS University, this gift of her bringing, in fact, Professor brought herself as a gift to us, and we just holding her in our hands, they said how healing the presence, the articulations, both simply and or very simple things in real life, but explained through scholarly research and knowledge that they felt spiritually healed. So for us, it's because we're coming from those difficult histories, this is more than academic knowledge in institutions. It's also about spiritual restitution as well as knowledge. So my own desire is that we have more of these conversations, more of these publications, because they state what you think is obvious. Like saying the word human is such an obvious thing, but you have to break it down. What is a black African subject in South Africa? How human are they compared to a guy sitting in the city of London who was born probably even after that person? And what kind of lifespan do they experience during that, from when you're born until you die? So it's not about the boy child. Again, it's what humanity do you offer people, because we only have life from when that boy child is born till he dies. Can he go home knowing he won't be killed?
Wow.
Can he go home knowing that he'll have a meal? You know, in Africa we cannot, and in the Caribbean and the black populations across the world, they cannot answer that question in the affirmative. So until we've answered that question, we will need to have Professor Carol Boyce Davis visiting the whole world.